I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 12 of Season 6 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again is David Brook of Blueprint Review. Welcome back to the show, David.
Hello, glad to be back talking about an old favorite of mine.
Yeah, just don't hurt my sore ear again. Episode 12 begins with George trying to explain to Gower what really happened, and ends with Clarence once again showing his simple-mindedness. So we ended things yesterday with George getting a beating from Mr. Gower, and George complaining not that you shouldn't be hitting me, but that you're hurting my sore ear. That's pretty much what he's doing. And you know, finally, at the end of yesterday's episode, George was trying to defend himself by explaining to Mr. Gower what's going on. He started saying, "Mr. Gower, you don't know." And he continues to deal with saying what you're doing. So basically it says, "You don't know what you're doing. You put something wrong in those capsules. I know you're unhappy. You got the telegram and you're upset. You put something bad in those capsules. It wasn't your fault, Mr. Gower. Just look and see what you did. The bottle you took the powder from, it's poison. I tell you, it's poison. I know you feel bad." And you know, it's great that you know, things are happening as George is talking. He's explaining to Mr. Gower what's going on. You know, once again, as we discussed yesterday, everything is being shot through the shelves. So we can see a lot of the various, I guess, medicines or ingredients that are used in the drugstore. I mean, the one that really stood out for me is sulfuric acid. Did you see that there's sulfur there?
Oh, yeah, I didn't spot that.
And I tried figuring out, like, what is it used for? Do you have any idea?
Oh, I don't know. My chemistry studies are a long way behind me.
Oh, mine are too. That's why I have Wikipedia. But, I mean, basically, it's used to fertilize crops. It can be used in fungicides or pesticides, which makes it somewhat dangerous if you have too much of it, which, again, is one of the things that we talked about last week, the idea that you know, like, why would a druggist have poison there? Because sometimes you need a little bit of poison to do something. It's not enough poison. You know, if the capsule has a little bit of poison in it, it could be doing some sort of, you know, it could be helping medically, but it's not necessarily going to kill you if you have in small doses. I mean, I brought this up last week also, but a few years ago, I went to a doctor and I needed medicine, and he gave me medicine, and before you can even take this medicine, you have to get a blood test, and they check like my liver levels before, and then, you know, every month before he would give me another prescription, I had to go and get another blood test just to make sure that the medicine wasn't affecting, you know, wasn't poisoning my liver, because it basically was poison. But the idea is that the poison is supposed to help with something else. It did help with what it needed to help with in the end for me. So, you know, I can't complain about that, but it explains why in certain circumstances you would give someone, I guess, mild doses of poison. You know, because whenever I saw this movie, I was always floored about the fact that why is he giving drugs? You know, why is he giving poison in the drugs and stuff like that? And now I understand it much better.
Well, there does seem to be a shop that sells a few different bits and pieces. It's like you've got the ice cream and stuff like that. So maybe it could be just rat poison or whatever to go. Although you'd have thought he'd store it somewhere different, but
no. But this is the back room. This is the you know, where he has the ingredients.
Yeah, the medicine. Yeah,
for the medicines and stuff like that. You know, true, it's not true, in the front. True. It's not next. It's not right next to the soda shop. You know,
no.
It's like, would you like some poison in your root beer? Yeah. Yeah, but
unless it's actually a sequel to Arsenic and Old Lace, he's knocking off old ladies in his spare time.
That's very true. I mean, sulfur can also be used in many pharmaceutical skin products to try and treat acne and things like that. And it can kill bacteria and fungus and scabies and mites and other types of parasites. So again, it's not something that you necessarily would want to have a lot of, but maybe, you know, maybe it could be, you know, helpful. It's they're actually sulfur is even used in batteries these days for rechargeable batteries.
Mm.
Put it together with lithium and stuff like that in order to, you know, using sulfur in it has helped keep things, you know, the longer lasting recharge cycles and stuff like that. So, yeah, that's just an interesting little tidbit about that. And, you know, as he's doing this, so we see that you know, Gower is starting to somewhat sober up and listen to him. And, you know, he's saying to himself, okay, maybe George is... maybe there's something here. You know, and, you know, George is crying as he's, I mean, the performance here is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if I remember correctly, you know, the actor here, Robert J. Anderson, plays the younger version of George, right? And he was 13 at the, or he was 12 or 13 when they filmed this, because he was born in 1933. He passed away in 2008. He was the production manager on Demolition Man and Passenger 57.
Wow.
He has 26 credits as a production manager, 24 as an actor, and he was a producer on seven films. You know, but
it's not a bad job. I mean, some of the, you could argue some of the line deliveries are have a slightly kind of delivered sort of sound, but I think emotionally he sells it. But H.P. Warner's was the key player in this scene for me. I think he's fantastic.
Yeah,
a lot of the movements as well, like when the change in temperament. So he's angry at the start, and like he snatches the pills away at first, and so he's still got that angry side going, and it kind of gradually changes as he starts to realize what he's done.
That's right. And I love the fact that he takes out a pill and he opens it. And what does he do to see if it's poison? He tastes it.
Tastes it.
Which, you know, it reminds me, like you see in movies, you know, when people are testing drugs and things like that, you know, they taste it, either whether it's a cop or whether it's sometimes, you know, they're doing a drug deal or something like that. They taste it and they know the taste. So, okay, you know, does that mean that he knows the various tastes of poison? Like he's going to, you know, taste this and he's going to go, oh, that's poison. Or is it the idea that this isn't the way that this medicine should taste?
You'd have thought he'd spit it out after tasting it.
Well, maybe at this point he wants to die, but that's a separate issue.
True.
You know, then he would have taken a lot more. But you see the realization come over his face.
Mm.
You know, as he's, you know, he like takes a little he takes a little bit of a taste of the drug, and then he realizes, wow, wait a second.
And we get a close-up for that key moment, so you can really see in his eyes the moment of realization.
And then he starts shaking, and, you know, he moves towards George with his hands apart as if, you know, he either is about to go strangle him or hug him.
Mm.
You know, and he and George backs away to get as far away from him as possible. And he goes, don't hurt my sore ear again. Don't hurt my sore ear again. He goes, oh, no, no, no. And he's Mr. Gower starts crying, and he goes, oh, George. And, you know, he begins to hug George as he's doing this. And George realizes that, you know, this is something that no one can ever find out about.
Mm.
And just by George volunteering the fact that, you know, his next line is, as George basically says, oh, Mr. Gower, I won't ever tell anybody. I know how you're feeling. I won't ever tell a soul. Hope to die, I won't.
Mm.
And Mr. Gower goes, oh, George. And, you know, it says so much about George's personality that even at this point, he's willing to keep that. I mean, I don't know if I could keep a secret like that. I would have told somebody, you know, but, you know, over the next 30 something years of this movie, he doesn't say anything to anybody. You know, he's able to, and, you know, as we talked about yesterday, Mary might know about this, but nobody else ever finds out.
No.
And, you know, that's a very big, you know, we talked a little bit about this last week, but the idea here is that, you know, that must be really, really dangerous for pharmacists, you know, that they need to be so careful about the exact amounts that they give people and stuff like that, you know, in the Back to the Future reality at the end of this movie, you know, I love the fact that that's what they did in Back to the Future. You know, for me, it's just great to use that. And anyone who's hearing me say this, I'm going to be saying it quite often throughout the rest of this movie, because it's a perfect example of what, you know, of a parallel universe that is created when something is changed.
Yeah.
You know, they just do a really good job of that. And, you know, and just like they do here. Here it's just for a few minutes. In Back to the Future 2, it's a little longer, but it still works really well. And the whole idea here is that in those scenes, so they say that you know, Gower was a child killer, you know, for maybe, I think he might even mention that it was for manslaughter that he went to jail, and then he got out of jail and he became a drunk, and, you know, he's the guy everyone's making fun of in town, you know. So, you know, George really saved him. There's no question about that here.
Yeah. There's a nice little push in at the end of that shot as well, where because we've been behind these bottles for ages, and it's nicely blocked. Like, they find this spot and the camera comes just between the bottles. It emphasizes the kind of importance of that moment. It's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it brings us closer to them through those, you know, through the shelves, where the two of them are hugging, as George is basically saying to him, "Don't worry, I'm never going to tell anybody about this. This is our secret. You know, don't worry about it." And once again, we have a nice fade out. And then, you know, the scene fades in again, and we see a completely different character. We don't know who this person is, if you've never seen this movie. All right. And, you know, it's a character named Joe, played by an actor named Ray Walker, who was born in 1904 and passed away in 1980. He has an astounding amount of IMDb credits. He has 274 credits.
Wow.
I mean, obviously, most of them are small parts, like in this movie. But still, you know, and his birth name is Warner Reynolds Walker, which I can understand why he would change it to Ray Walker. And we see in the back the name of, or part of the name of the store. At the beginning, it's the Boston Co. something, right? And you know, as the scene moves along, we actually can see that it's the Boston Co. suitcases, and then underneath it says "and sporting goods." So this is not, because, like, my first question was, is why does Bedford Falls need a luggage shop? You know. It's a small town in, you know, upstate New York. I'm assuming people do go on vacations and people do need it, but I don't know if you need a shop solely for luggage. So it's nice that they would have a dual purpose of for the shop, where it's also a sporting goods shop at the same time.
Yeah, sporting goods. You'd have thought sporting goods might come before suitcases in this kind of town, but I guess maybe not.
That's true also.
That's a good point. Popular.
Yeah, no, I didn't even think about that. Sporting goods stores, when, you know, are basically, they're not as, you know, as sole, the sporting goods stores that we know of today is not what they have here in the movie. You know, this is basically a store that sells luggage and also has some sporting goods, but I don't think it's the same thing as, like, when you go to Champion or, or you know, all the different what Decathlon, I think, is the name of a big store.
Decathlon's a European one, yeah.
Yeah. So when do you think, like, when did Decathlon start opening the chain? Do you know?
Decathlon. Oh, Decathlon.
Decathlon is the world's largest sporting good chain.
Wow. Maybe the 60s, I don't know.
1976.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So and since then, how many stores do you think they have?
Oh, they're all over. I see them all over the world. I don't know, maybe, I don't know, 500.
There are 1,700 stores.
1,700?
Located in over 30 countries, 60 countries.
Wow.
You know, the number used to actually be larger, but due to the global financial crisis during, 2007 and 2008, so a lot of the stores closed up. And obviously during COVID, they also had trouble and closed up a bunch of their stores. Another store is Dick's Sporting Goods in the U.S., where they would actually they let people have in-store experiences. They would have, like, putting greens and yoga classes and rock climbing and batting cages, you know, things in the store itself to try and get people to come into these stores. So, yeah, it's very, very interesting. And basically, you know, Joe starts talking and, you know, we hear him say, an overnight bag, genuine English cowhide, combination lock, fitting up with brushes, combs. And so my first question is, okay, why do you need brushes and combs? Or why does George need them in a suitcase? You know, you're buying a suitcase. You're not buying a horse. You're not buying, I don't know.
Well, hairbrush, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just a very strange comment, you know, that he's talking about all the different things that they have there. And, you know, I understand why he would say, you know, genuine English cowhide, you know, talking about the different types of leather and stuff like that, that it has a combination lock, but that it's fitted with brushes and combs. You know, that's not necessarily what's going to sell, you know, a piece of luggage. Or maybe back in the 40s, or this is in the 1920s. So maybe back then, it is possible. I don't know. We'll find out later this week the actual date of what year this is taking place. Do you have any guess at this point? What year this takes place?
Oh, what happens in there? I'm trying to think. It's before. When does they get off the wall?
I think on Thursday we'll find out. Because they give us we get to see a newspaper article that tells us what is actually going on. We actually even know the exact date of when this is taking place, which is amazing that they were able to do that. You know, but I'm not going to tell you what it is at this point. But I just wanted to see if you have a guess.
I'd guess kind of
The original part, the thing in the drugstore took place in 1919.
Okay.
Yeah, just to give you an idea.
Oh,
so
I might be thinking later on there. I'm trying to think the order of when things happen. I was going to say like 38, but it might, well, maybe. He obviously looks older than I think he's supposed to be. He's supposed to be younger, isn't he, at this point?
Yeah.
So it's probably supposed to be like 35, 34.
What, 1934 or 1935? Or he's supposed to be 34, 35?
No, 1934, 1935. Yeah.
All right, well, we just have to gonna hold on and wait until I think Thursday to find out exactly what that is. And he mentions here, Joe also mentions the fact of a combination lock. You know, which basically it's a locking device that you have sequences of symbols, which are usually numbers that are used to open the lock. And you have to enter them, you know, using there's a rotating dial inside. It's actually very cool. I found a diagram that shows how it works, and I never even thought about it. You know you have within the cylinder on the inside, you have like a groove that will, you know, that's where the inner piece of the lock will move up, and that's by that particular number, you know, if you're twisting it around and stuff like that, so that the key will then fit in, or, you know, they'll be able to open it exactly the way it is. So I just thought that was really, really cool.
That's cool. What I find even cooler is that ones, because you can quite often change the combination yourself or set the combination yourself. So I always wonder how that's done, because I've always kind of understood how it works on a basic level, but to be able to reset it, I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know about that stuff. When do you
simpler than it looks?
That's right. When do you think the earliest known combination lock was? I guess you could say invented.
Oh, I'd probably say it'd be a Victorian thing, maybe 1880s, maybe.
They actually found one. They found one from a Roman period tomb.
Wow.
In Athens, where there was a small box that had several dials inside, several dials instead of keyholes that were used. And then in 1206, wow. The Muslim engineer Al-Jazari, he wrote a book and explained, you know, how a combination lock would work. And they actually have found combination locks that were, one of them is in Copenhagen and another one's in a Boston museum, you know, from that period. So yeah, it's just really cool that it goes the back of that far. You know, it's not something you necessarily would think of. You know, and then the first viable single dial combination lock was patented in 1910 by the American Lock Company. And then, you know, you have multiple dial locks. Those are the type of locks that we were talking about, which, you know, people use on bicycles or briefcases or suitcases and things like that, you know, where it's just a question of getting the numbers. So, you know, that's something that's become very popular. Because they're simpler to make. So
yeah, I don't save you having to remember a key or anything like that. Yeah, quite handy.
I don't know. I don't know. I think key is better, but I don't know. I mean, we had a case of
keys always. I was gonna say keys always seem sturdy, like a safer option. But I guess just for ease of use and for anyone who loses keys regularly, it makes sense.
Right. I mean,
I'd never want a combination lock on anything super important, though, I guess. But I think for, like, they're brilliant. For me, I always think of a combination lock as being most useful. Is that if you go to the gym and you have the ones that you put on the little lockers, mm-hmm. because it just saves faffing around and carrying a key around with you if you're going to the gym. But, yeah.
Right. I mean, we had an incident, I guess it was about 3 months ago, where we couldn't find the key to our shed. And we were sure that one of our sons had actually used it like a week and a half before, and we asked him and he didn't know where it was. He says he put it back where it was supposed to go, and we couldn't find the key, and we didn't know where the spare key was, and we ended up having to get a locksmith come to break the padlock in order for us to be able to get into the shed. And last week my son said, "Hey, look what I found in my pair of pants that was in the closet." And we were like, "Oh, crap."
Oh yeah, I've had that happen before.
Yeah. And, you know, we were sure back then that it was him, but, you know, he said it wasn't him. So we believed him. Maybe we should have gone through every single one of those, pairs of pants in his closet, you know, but oh, well, and, you know, George is not interested in this. And he goes, no. Now look, Joe, I want a big one. And he like holds his hands out as if he's like trying to capture a big fish, or he had just gotten, you know, he just caught a big fish or something like that. And, you know, and then they do a great freeze frame here. You know, we get to see Jimmy Stewart, you know, frozen in time. And then we hear Clarence's voice say, "What did you stop it for?" And then Joseph says, "I want you to take a good look at that face." "Who is it?" "George Bailey." "Oh, you mean?" So again, it's this is more for us, but I don't like the way that they're portraying Clarence in because they're doing it this way. I don't think he's, I mean, the first week we talked a little bit about the fact that they sort of were belittling Clarence's intelligence. But come on, he's being told the story and then, you know, jumps to something else. You think that he's going to be able to figure out that when you're stopping it on somebody, so that must be George.
Yeah.
You know, so
it's spelling things out a bit too much. Yeah.
Yeah.
Said, although it's quite a nice little moment with the freeze frame and them talking about the freeze frame. It's a nice early example of kind of a reflexivity, postmodernism in film, although I'm sure there are plenty more.
Yeah, but it's also you know we were talking yesterday about the, you know, the technical aspects of making a movie back in the 40s as opposed to making them today, you know, with the wipes. But it's the same idea here. You know, this is also something that I guess was somewhat groundbreaking at the time, that they're able to stop mid frame, keep the frame on us, you know, keep the frame frozen, and then have the, you know, insert the dialogue over that. With the two characters talking.
Yeah, and it's a technique people still use now. You get a lot of these kind of quirky indie movies and things doing freeze frames and a caption or some sort of... I'm trying to think of Zombieland. Like, Zombieland does that sometimes, yeah. Doesn't it? It's got the freeze frames and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's still going strong. And,
yeah.
It's hard to think of anything earlier than that. There may be, but I'd have to have a think.
I'm assuming there were, but what it comes down to is that it's probably much easier to do today than it was back then.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. Just a click of a button, it's so easy. Yeah.
That's right. And so that's pretty much everything I have to say about this minute. You have anything else for this minute before we get into today's segment?
No, not really. As I mentioned, I think it's a nice. The end is. I've talked about the first section already, really, but it's a nice little fun intro to Jimmy Stewart. I kind of like the way he's introduced now. It's a bit more of a light-hearted, fun introduction to the character, so works for me. It's a nice little moment.
Okay, great. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track, Uplifting Experience Edition, where my guests will give some sort of story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure, or something has happened to them over the course of their life, or some sort of story that they can tell us that was somewhat of an uplifting experience for them or someone maybe they know or something like that. So, David, you got a story for us?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, it's not a mega anecdote, really. I think it's more – I struggled with this a little bit, to be honest. Less anecdotey, but more just feel-good general kind of things that have happened. But, yeah, my I guess it must be 9 months ago or so or something like that. Or maybe less, but anyway, yeah, it was around about just after Christmas, I guess. My mum and dad have taken in a Ukrainian family because they were looking for places to house a lot of the people, the refugees coming out of the country, and my mum and dad have put them up in their house for quite a few months. And I think for me, in an uplifting story that I've well, not really sorry, but something uplifting that I've experienced is seeing how people kind of came to help and support them. It was crazy that, like, they came to live in mum and dad's kind of little village in Yorkshire, and they'd just got so many people coming up and giving them clothes and giving them toys, because there's a young daughter and a kind of teenage son, and they were bringing them everything they needed. It was just crazy, and they're just about almost at the end of their kind of period of staying with mum and dad's, and then they have to kind of find their own place, and but they're gonna stay in the area and get their own house. But from then as well, like one of our family friends has basically donated an entire house worth of furniture.
Oh wow!
Because they were getting rid of, I think they're I think one of their mothers had, or father had died, and they had all the spare furniture, and they're just giving it to this Ukrainian family to so it's it has been very touching to see people rally together and do all they can to help these guys who've had to move away from their home and move to a foreign country where they don't speak the language, and they're kind of living there now. So it's that has been very, very moving.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How did your parents communicate with them if they don't speak the language?
Well, they
Google Translate.
Mobile phones. Yeah, they've got. Well, they use a different one. I think it's very similar to Google Translate. I can't remember. I think it's called Say Hi. I think it's something like that, where it just kind of live translations. You speak into it and it translates for you. It's not perfect. We've come across some unusual translations, which have caused much amusement. But yeah, and also the son. He's about 16, I think. His English, he had a bit of English, he could speak a little, and since living in England, he and his sister's 8, I think, and since they've been in English schools, they've been really picking up the language, and their mum has learned a little bit, as she's getting better, so it's taken time. But yeah, the initial couple of months, it was just purely doing the telephone, which is very weird.
Well, that makes it sound like something out of science fiction, you know, where you have what is it in Star Trek? You have the universal translator?
Yeah, pretty much.
So the universal translator in the Brooke household.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That is great. Thank you for that uplifting and inspiring story, Dave. Thank your parents for taking them in.
Yeah, no worries.
Exactly. All right, so you want to once again tell people where they can find David Brooke?
Yeah, so I write over at blueprintreview.co.uk, where I review lots of classic indie world cinema, anything that takes my fancy, really, usually on shiny discs.
Shiny discs are good. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.